This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, The 11th Demon, The Ark of Chaos, and the author is Bruce Hennigan, and Bruce joins us now on Indie Book Publishing. This interview brought to you by Westbow Press. Hello, Bruce.
Hello, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Well, here we go again with Jonathan Steele. He's a demon hunter by trade, but he must once again face a supernatural foe as a new evil cult rises from the darkness and threatens to engulf the world in chaos. So you've got us on the edge of our seat again.
And it's, I wrote this book 4 or 5 years ago, but man, is the world really on the edge of chaos. You know, it's kind of timely.
Yes.
It's a supernatural thriller with a lot of reference to conspiracy theories and secret societies, and I hope people enjoy reading it.
So we have book three in the Ark of Chaos. Jonathan has been battling Vivian Darbon right from the beginning?
That's right. In the first two books, Jonathan Steele is trying to recover his memory, suffering from amnesia, ends up battling demons, and is beginning to discover that this is becoming his purpose. And one of his recurring foes is a young woman named Vivian Darbon, who wants to become a member of the Council of Darkness, which is sort of Satan's main, sort of his United Nations sort of thing. It's his group of demons that carry out his plans. And so in each book, she ends up facing off against Jonathan Steele, trying to take the place of that particular demon that he's defeating in that book. And so there's 12 demons that he's going to work his way through. And the first two books were the 13th and the 12th demon. The 13th was kind of a demon who wants to be on the council and couldn't be on the council. And now we're up to demon number 11. And Vivian Darbon knows that if she can find this Ark of Chaos, which is sort of an evil opposite to the Ark of the Covenant, that she can control the members of the council and become a member of this Council of Darkness. So
as we count down these demons from number 13 down to number 1, these demons become more and more powerful. He's taking on greater and greater evil forces.
That's correct. They get more and more powerful. This Council of Darkness is like the 12 smartest and strongest of the demons that Satan chose, much like Jesus chose his 12 disciples. He chose his 12 demons to sort of offset the work of God and the work of goodness 2,000 years ago. So down through the centuries, Satan has used this Council of Darkness in my storyline to thwart goodness and to bring down governments, to bring chaos into the world. And over time, there's always been a human host for each one of these demons. And that's what Vivian wants to become. She wants to become a host to a group of demons that makes her powerful and join the Council of Darkness. And Jonathan Steele, unfortunately, has sort of been drafted into this battle against these demons with each book. And he's beginning to build a team to help him combat this evil. And this book, The 11th Demon, sort of brings together his team, if you will, and solidifies his realization that this is his purpose now, to combat evil and to fight against these demons on the Council of Darkness.
How did this book series come about?
Well, I decided to write the first book because I wanted to talk about the reality of evil and good and angels and demons, and I'm an apologist, which means someone who defends the Christian faith through science, history, and philosophy. And so I wanted to write a book sort of like what Michael Crichton used to do. You know, when he wrote Jurassic Park was about dinosaurs, but it was really about chaos theory and genetic engineering and the dangers of fooling around with nature. So I wanted to write a story that was thrilling and fast-paced. They used elements of the spiritual warfare, and so that's where I began my journey with the first book. And by creating the character of Jonathan Steele, who has amnesia, in each book we rediscover the mystery of his past. He He doesn't know who he is or where he came from. And so each book is sort of a mystery. He discovers a little bit more about himself, and he realizes his destiny is tied in with the destiny of this Council of Darkness. So in each book, I explore some interesting and fascinating features, like the 11th Demon talks about, heresies, secret societies, conspiracy theories.
So you're answering the question, do governments or secret societies really carry out deeds behind the curtain of secrecy that change the world around us?
Yes, that's the question that I ask in the book, and because many people think conspiracy theories are created and they're not true, and in some instances that is true, but there are indeed conspiracies that go on behind the scenes, and there are secret societies down through the ages which have tried to affect government and change the course of business and governments, and so this is a reality, and I base my secret society in the book on a real heresy called from a character named Simon Magus, who was a magician, and so there's some truth to the secret society that I create in this book, and there's truthfulness to some of the conspiracies that I talk about, which I don't want to give that away, because that's part of the mystery of the book, is what conspiracy am I talking about? Did it really happen, and where does it lead with this arc of chaos? So.
Well, as we've said, this is a thriller, this is fiction, but at the same time, as you point out at the beginning of the book, in Ephesians 6, right out of the Bible, it talks about these rulers of darkness, these powers that are not so much flesh and blood, but powers of wickedness in heavenly places.
Right. And it talks about using principalities, which are governments, and create, institutions of men to carry out their evil deeds. So I kind of explore all of that in this book, and I also go into the backstory of one of my main characters, Jonathan Steele's mentor, is Dr. Cephas Lawrence, who sort of like Yoda, was to Luke in Star Wars. He is sort of Jonathan Steele's mentor, and we get into his backstory, which is intimately tied in with this conspiracy and with the secret society. And we learn more about him and why he is so fascinated with evil and what secret from his past drove him to help Jonathan Steele fight these demons. And there's also a storyline in here from the viewpoint of the 11th demon, who was there when the angels were cast out of heaven, who fell. And part of his story recounts his experience with Lucifer rebelling against God and the angels being cast out. And so you kind of get a little bit of a insight into that part of the story from the Bible, of course, which is never filled out in the Bible. I take a little bit of liberty, but I think there's a lot of truth in there, in that story. So it's kind of interesting. So,
well, as some point out, that your book is an exciting, fast-paced, supernatural thriller. At the same time, we often wonder, why is there so much chaos in the world? We certainly have to look at what you are revealing.
Yes, I think so. One of the issues I talk about in the book, and this, when it gets a little bit more serious for about a half a chapter, is how we live in a culture that no longer believes in God or believes in absolutes and believes in right and wrong. We live in a very relativistic culture that embraces the idea that anything is permissible, anything can be right, anything can be wrong just based on your situation. And when you walk away from the idea that there are fixed laws of right and wrong, you begin to undermine the whole foundation of your culture and your government and your laws. And I think a lot of what we're seeing in the United States and in the world today, this chaos and confusion, is because we're embracing this idea that there's no longer an absolute right and wrong. There's no longer a meta-narrative or a big story that God is unfolding. We don't believe in that anymore. So we create our own stories. And as human beings, we're so flawed, we tend to mess things up. So no wonder we live in chaos. And that metaphor there works into the arc of chaos. What's in this arc? When you open it up, what is going to release chaos on the world? What does that mean to live in chaos and confusion? So there's kind of an undercurrent there in the story that explores that whole social and cultural issue.
Who is the Tomb Master and his apprentice Quibble?
Those are an interesting creation that actually came from my first book. My editor that I was working with on the first book said, you kind of need someone to introduce every story. And so I came up with this idea that there's a tome master, an evil sort of a demon who documents all of these stories. And Quibble is his assistant, who inputs the stories into a special device that stores them over time. So it gives me an opportunity every now and then to step away from the story and see it from their point of view. It's just kind of a fun little literary device. He crops up at the beginning of every book. And in fact, in the next book, which will hopefully be out in the next 3 or 4 months, you get to meet him in person, because you get to actually meet the Council of Darkness and actually meet Quibble and the Tome Master as they're setting up to record a meeting of the Council of Darkness. So he's going to become fleshed out as the book unfolds. And who is Quibble? Ordinary human being who was taken in by a demon, and you learn more about that in the future too.
So. And so that's this group of stories. You call it the Grimvox.
Exactly, the Grimvox is the collection. It's sort of like their version of the Bible. You know, this is the evil, the repository of all the evil stories and deeds over the last 2,000 years.
So your pastor had former pastor had a hand in all of this.
Yes. My former pastor is Mark Sutton, and Mark has encouraged me over the years to write and encourage my stories. And he and I have written a book on depression, which came out in 2001. In fact, next month in September, we're releasing an update to that book called Hope Again, a 30-Day Plan for Conquering Depression. So he has himself written a couple of thriller supernatural novels about angels and demons. So we kind of have told each other stories, encouraged each other, read our works, and continue to encourage us to move on, keep writing books, don't stop. So.
And the title of this next one, which would be, let's see, The Tenth Demon.
The Children of the Bloodstone is the name of it. I talk about UFOs and extraterrestrials and aliens and alien abductions and get into all of that fun territory, sort of an X-Files vibe to that book. So it's going to be a lot of fun. I've enjoyed writing a book about UFOs and aliens. It's kind of scary, too, really creepy. So hopefully it'll be out before the end of the year. So.
And, of course, besides this spiritual battle between good and evil that is a major theme throughout your book, as you put it, there's more to life than just living and dying. What is that about?
Well, I think, you know, we go back to what I said a while ago about our culture. If we don't believe in God, if we don't believe that there's something transcendent to us, then it is, you just live and you die. You're just biochemistry. You're just your brain and your body, and we're controlled by our genes and our instincts. And there's no justification for things like beauty and art and music and the written word. But because we have these elements that enrich our lives as human beings, have got to come from somewhere. And I think that's a reflection of our being created in the image of God, God the creator. So we love to create. We love to make things of beauty and art. And so that enriches our life. We don't just lurch from day to day, you know, living and living until we die. We make the world a better place through story and art. And part of that is our worship of the creator God of the universe. That's what I believe, and that's what drives me to write my books and to tell my stories.
So Jonathan Steele must find this Ark of Chaos before the world descends into darkness, complete darkness.
That's right. He's got to keep it out of the hands of Vivian Darbone and keep it out of the hands of the 11th demon, because whoever gets a hold of the Ark of Chaos will have a lot of control and will be able to unleash chaos on the world, and we don't want that. So he's got to stop them, you know.
Well, your books have been likened to the Twilight series. We all can probably remember
yeah.
those.
Well, my second book was about vampires, so yeah, it was only my vampires were real vampires. You know, they were not sparkly skinned little, you know, pretty little boys and girls who ran around during the day. So it kind of has that vibe to it, too. Now, this book doesn't involve vampires, but it does involve some pretty creepy creatures that I call vitriomancers, and you have to read the book to find out what that's all about. They're pretty creepy. And then, again, that is based on an ancient heresy and secret society from about the 300 to 400 AD period of time. So
we've been listening to Bruce Hennigan, the author of his newest book in his series, The Jonathan Steele Chronicles, The 11th Demon, The Ark of Chaos. Bruce, tell us, what's the best way to get your book?
Best way is to go to 11thdemon.com. That's 11thdemon.com. That's my website for the book. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it on Barnes & Noble. You can have your local bookstore order it. It's a traditionally carried book. It's not print on demand, so you can get it from all of your major ebook dealers, and or you can go to my website, 11thdemon.com. I have a special there where you can order the book and the other three books for a discount price directly from me.
Thanks so much, Bruce, for joining us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thanks for having me, Steve. I appreciate it.
And this interview has been brought to you by Wespo Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, everybody. This is Pete Six of Beatles and Beyond. Why don't we all come together and hear some of the tracks off the latest Beatles release on this radio station? Yes, why don't you look up the schedules on this radio station and join me and Beatles listeners everywhere to hear these latest releases from the Beatles on Beatles and Beyond with Pete Dix.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing Balboa Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book is titled Primary Gift, Awaken to the Excellence of Your Life's Journey. And our author who joins me from Arizona is Kelly Holland. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your book is an introspective and an inspirational book. Would that be the right way to describe it?
Yes, it's an inspirational and spiritual memoir. And it tells the story of my life story, and it is presented to inspire readers to become aware of the excellence of their life's journey and to know that there is perfection in everything that they live and to trust that the universe is guiding their life ultimately and perfectly, and to trust how it unfolds.
Well, you took a topic that was very easy for you to write because, like many people, you didn't have any problems growing up, other than the fact that your mother had schizophrenia and your father was an alcoholic. Pretty easy start. How did that affect your life?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Jay, because from very early on in life, despite my mother's schizophrenia, I knew that I was a teacher. From the young age of 2, I was fully aware of my divine connection. And I had a sense that ultimately I was going to grow up to be a teacher. I didn't realize that I would be a teacher as a physical therapist, but more of a spiritual teacher. And with my mother's schizophrenia, it presented challenges that were profound. And they led me to seek assistance from professionals that helped guide me to the wisdom that I ultimately would develop. And that is really the purpose of writing my book, is to share my wisdom so others can benefit from my life's journey.
Did you have siblings also in the family?
Yes, I have 2 brothers and a sister, and their life journey has not been easy either, but we all have kind of gone our own ways and have learned our own lessons, so to speak. And for some reason, my journey has been very atypical when you look at the process of life, how we live. I lived in a group home when I was in my teenage years, and that had a profound effect on me. And I became a professional late in my 30s. And so my journey has been different than my siblings, but we have all come to understand our life in a very powerful way, but in different ways.
You have 164 pages. What is the audience you hope to reach with your book?
Oh, I really appreciate you asking that question. I want to reach out to teenagers especially because I truly can connect with their struggles. This was a time in my life that was ultimately challenging for me, and I know that teenagers especially these years can be very, very trying, and I want to inspire teenagers to know that ultimately they can live the life that they dream of if they trust that the universe is helping them. I also want to teach teenagers that their parents have had struggles also, and if they can have an understanding and an appreciation for where their parents are coming from, ultimately it will help them to live the life that they want to live. I also want to connect with people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, the elderly, because I am a physical therapist, and because of everything that I've learned along my journey, I'm a very powerful physical therapist and teacher, and I understand the body intrinsically, and I am a teacher of wellness, and so I have a strong desire to connect to women and men from their 20s on up into the elderly years. And I want to connect with the spiritual audience. My mother's schizophrenia from a very early age really, really forced me to connect to the divine. And I have a very powerful connection with the divine. And through the poetry of the book, I'm able to express the genius of the universe. And in this way, I can reach other people who are spiritually motivated or inspired.
You say you want to reach teenagers. Now, as we know, teenagers have a lot of challenges, even if they grew up in a fairly typical home. You had some challenges. Did you get sidetracked and attracted towards substance abuse of any type?
I did. And, you know, as a professional today, this is something that, you know, I hesitate to speak about because I don't want it to impede me in any way, but at the same time, it was probably the one thing that saved my life, actually, was the drug abuse, and it went into my adult years, and it was something that protected me from the chaos that lived within me because of my mother's schizophrenia and all of the chaos that was related to that. And the drug abuse, it protected me, and it served its purpose. And then through a very, very powerful relationship with my psychologist, I was able to work through the need of needing drugs, and I was able to reconnect to the universe and use the universe as my guide, and I was able to walk away from drug addiction. But I fully understand it, and it is a powerful message that I want to communicate and want to help others to understand.
You also have been impacted by others. Who might those be? Anybody that we would know or recognize?
Yes, this is another very powerful part of my book is role models who present into our life. And some people I'm sure know her. Her name is Celine Dion. And I was gifted with one of her concerts in 1999 through a very, very dear friend in my life. And on that night, March 29th, 1999, my life changed. When I saw Celine perform for the first time, it was that night that I changed internally. The sadness that I had carried for decades lifted because of the excellence that I had seen in Celine and the excellence that she performed. It raised my spirit, my energy to a new level. And it was on that night that I knew that I wanted to talk with the world about the excellence that lived within each one of us. And on that night, I dreamed about meeting Celine one day, but only when I could do so from my own place of excellence. And for years, I have used Celine as a role model in my life, her standard, how she stands in the music industry as such a powerful, stable entity. And I use her excellence to guide my life. And I want to inspire others to recognize role models for what they are. They inspire us. They inspire us. But it's up to us to use their influence to then allow us to do the work necessary to become all we can be.
Kelly, when you decided to write your book and share your story, how long did it take to complete?
You know, it's interesting. It took about 10 months, actually, to write the book, to really put it out on paper. But it took me about 3 years from start to finish to complete the entire process.
What message came through besides telling your story? What is the inspiration that you want to pass along?
The inspiration is that any dream, any life that you can dream, you can live fully. It doesn't matter where we start. It's where we are headed that matters most. I think that so many people that I encounter, they, you know, either through physical therapy or by talking with others generally, that we allow our life circumstances to dictate ultimately what we live. And I know that where I've come from does not have to determine what I ultimately live in life. And I want to share that message. I want to inspire others to see the excellence in their life's journey and to feel inspired to share their story and to ultimately believe and know that anything they can dream, they can live fully.
Take a couple of sentences and really speak to my listening audience and get them interested in Primary Gift.
Primary Gift is a book that will inspire you and will touch you with the loving heart of the universe. The universe is the genius of all that is. And through the poetry of the book, we are able to see the genius on full display. And I have to tell you that that Primary Gift, it is a memoir, but it really is a self-help book that as you read it and you learn of my life story, you'll start to fully understand the excellence in your own life story, and you'll be inspired to not only live your best life, but to inspire others that there is excellence in your journey and to trust everything that unfolds in your life.
Each written memoir is unique in its own merit. Is yours a little bit different than others out there?
It is different because my book is written with such honesty. And I did so because it was so important to me that the reader have a full understanding of my life's journey so they could truly see the excellence in the three teachers especially that have come forward. I share very deeply my relationship with Denise Gulledge, my psychologist, and I do so the reader can fully understand what has taken place, the power of my mother's schizophrenia, how it truly it destabilized me for a great portion of my life, and how Denise came forward for decades to help me understand what happened and to ultimately help me to become the person I am today. So many people look at psychotherapy as a weakness, and truly it is not a weakness. It's a strength to seek out exemplary professionals to help us. And that is what's different about my book. It's written with such honesty, and it's done so because it is truly meant to inspire the reader to know that it's okay to share our story and to share it so deeply, and that when I trust the reader can then turn around and trust others.
What was the challenge that you had to overcome in order to share your feelings, share your life, and complete Primary Gift?
Yes. You know, Jay, there is sadness that comes forward as I share my years of struggle and of my mom's schizophrenia. This was hard to write and to allow others to know. It took a lot of courage to allow others in so deeply. And I struggled with the energy that the reader would inevitably encounter as they read this part of the book. And furthermore, I share so honestly my relationship with Denise, as I have spoke of, something that was so private but yet so powerful. But she is truly my life's primary gift and the reason that I wrote this book. And it was only right that I share her so intensely with the world. And there is so much to appreciate from knowing her, and I wanted to share this with the world. And as I tell my story courageously and with such honesty, I tell the world that we have nothing to hide and everything to gain. And in order for the reader to understand the excellence of my journey and truly the teachings of my life, they needed to experience the entire journey. Because my overall message is to inspire, uplift, and serve as a model of excellence for living your best life.
The book is titled Primary Gift. My author, Kelly Holland, Awaken to the Excellence of Your Life's Journey, her memoir. Kelly, thank you for joining me today. Where can my listeners get copies of your book?
Yes, my book is currently for sale on Amazon, and it is also for sale through Balboa Press. And Balboa Press, if you go to their website, www.balboapress.com, you can follow the links through their website and find the book or through Amazon. And these are current. There'll be more publication to come forward in the months ahead.
Kelly, thank you for sharing your story and for sharing the honesty that's included in the pages and in the covers of Primary Gift.
Thank you so much, Jay. It's a pleasure to be here.
For Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press, this is Jay Douglas Parker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Helen Wu was born and raised in San Francisco's Chinatown, and after a very difficult upbringing, fighting depression, abuse, and addictions, she finally finds herself genuinely happy inside and out. Helen believes in taking our positive thinking and doing something positive to achieve a positive outcome. She's here to make a positive difference in your life, to be your game changer, your aha moment mentor. She's ready to help both men and women get into a better place. Helen Wu is also the author of Self-Aid Success Stories, 25 Success Stories from Successful Entrepreneurs. Inspired by Ellen DeGeneres, Helen wants the world to know that just because we find ourselves in a difficult situation doesn't mean we have to stay there. We can aid ourselves to a better life. So join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Faced with the realization that control may not actually be on the true path to authentic happiness, Virginia is at a crossroads. If she can't control everyone and everything around her, what's to keep her life from spiraling into chaos? Virginia has too many questions and not enough answers. Somewhere on her path from human doing to human being, an epiphany awaits. But can she let go long enough to find it? Just a small part of what's inside the new book called Saving Virginia. The author of that book, Melinda Edwards, joins us on the Indie Book Publishing line, courtesy of Balboa Press, from her office in Queensland, Australia. Hello, Melinda. How are you today?
Hi, Clint. I'm fabulous this morning. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing terrific. All the way in Australia today. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Before we get going, Melinda, you have such an extensive and impressive resume in academia, in law. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, it's not that impressive, really, Clint. I think I just hung on in there for a long time. I started as a litigation lawyer, and that gave me some really interesting insights into the culture of law firms. When I wanted to have a family, I then moved to become an academic and worked my way up that very tall ladder to finally become a professor of law and the assistant dean in my faculty, which was a really interesting experience because it took me outside of Australia and into a more international realm. And once I'd done that work and done some work in developing countries, I decided that I really wanted to set up a social enterprise business of my own that would enable me to generate income that I could then spend on causes that I believed were worthwhile without the bureaucracy of the aid organizations. They do a fantastic job and they're really well motivated, but it can be quite difficult to provide the aid in places where it's most needed from the experience that I had. And from that, I made a whole lot of transitions myself. My life in the middle of all of that fell apart, really. And I've become wistfully fond of the saying that when things fall apart, sometimes the only way for them to come together again differently. And that's what I found in my own journey, which led me to write this story about that and my experiences along the way.
Again, the name of the book is Saving Virginia. With us today is author Melinda Edwards. So give us a brief introduction into Virginia, into Saving Virginia. Give us kind of the thumbnail sketch of what the storyline is in this book.
Virginia is a control freak lawyer, and that's not a judgmental label, because I think a lot of working people, and particularly working women, mothers, find themselves as control freaks as a matter of necessity. Every quark of their energy is committed to keeping everybody else's lives afloat, and the only way to manage all of that, to keep our nose above water, is to keep very tight control of everything to make sure that the schedules all work. So becoming a control freak is probably, I think, a product very much of our modern world. And Virginia finds that when things change, as they inevitably do, and she is struggling to resist them, that at some point she has to release control. She has to acknowledge that she can't control everything and everyone. Some fairly big messages come at her in her storyline, which mean that she has to sit back in that very uncomfortable place about, well, if I can't control everything, how am I going to be? And particularly because at a certain point in our lives, I think for women especially, if we are divorced, when our children grow up and leave home, if our career has to transition as our family's needs change, then we find ourselves with all those, without all of those familiar roles and crutches. And when you aren't the long-suffering wife, the devoted mother, the benevolent boss, who are you? And that can be a confronting question.
Melinda, in this story and in your own personal experience, do you find we get ourselves into these kind of situations because we let others determine our happiness? Is that what happened to Virginia in this novel?
I very much so. I agree with that, Clint. And I, again, that's not a judgmental assessment. We live in such a fast world, and we live in a world of mixed messages. And as we grow up, of course, we adopt the values of those around us, and we accept the guidance of those who are trying to help us. And according to their experience, the way for us to succeed is to be like them. So we adopt other people's definitions of happiness and success. And Virginia finds that she's worked conscientiously her entire life to tick all of the boxes for content, for conventional success and happiness, and yet here she is at the age of almost 50, completely miserable. So I think most of us tend to find ourselves in that situation at some point in our lives, unless we've had fantastic, wise spiritual guidance from somebody at the beginning to say, follow your own passion, follow your own intuition, and we've been able to stay in connection with that. Virginia, unfortunately, had to learn that a little late in her story, but once she does, she finds that her life turns around exponentially.
Now, with Virginia, I don't want to call her a stereotypical lady of this generation, but she is working. She's a mom. She goes through some marital problems, and that's really common in today's society. Wanted to pick one thing interesting that you had in some of your information about your book. You kind of dealt with a self-destructive teenager, much like Virginia has to in Saving Virginia. Tell us a little bit about dealing with that.
I actually have so many friends who are dealing with the issues with their teenagers, about which really resolve from the fact that our teenagers often don't love themselves anywhere near as much as we love them. And so we find the choices that they make and the way that they assess themselves to be completely the opposite of the unconditional love that we want to give them. And I think we all know as parents that if you're dealing with a young person that is feeling disenfranchised, disaffected, and disempowered in the world, it's such a trick to try to empower them and to try to help them to see the person that we see that they could be. I certainly had experience with that, and I think that a lot of women that I know have had that experience in the modern world. It's, we talk about malaise and self-destruction and anorexia and cutting syndromes as a particular malaise of the modern world. And as a, an assistant dean in the Faculty of Law, I certainly saw a huge number of those sorts of conscientious, intelligent, but self-destructive young people. So that was a quandary that I dealt with both professionally and personally. And I wanted to shine a light on some of the fears that come from that situation, but also shine a light on the ways that I have seen people deal with that and come through the other side with a relationship intact, but most importantly, with a relationship with themselves that allows them to not blame themselves for what is going on in the world around them.
On the flip side of that, Melinda, at least with the story of Virginia, we have the mom over here, and then on the flip side, we have the professional. And I think we all catch ourselves getting into this. We have to know everything. We have to look good. We have to appear to be, make all the right decisions. And you believe that in itself can make us miserable.
Absolutely. I actually teach conflict resolution and have for many years, and I learned early on that it's the ego or that story of ourselves that we need to be able to tell, to know, to look good, to be right, that often actually leads us to really unwise solutions. Wanting to look right and be right means we have to make other people wrong, and when we're making other people wrong, we are burning bridges. We are cutting off avenues to achieve wise solutions that might bring value to both sides. So it's quite a sign of inner insecurity, I think, to be hostile to the unfamiliar. And so we, if we can get over that and open ourselves to the idea that nobody else expects us to be right all the time, we are just human beings, if we don't expect that of ourselves, we can actually negotiate with others in a much wiser way, and we can find better value solutions for not only ourselves but those around us. It seems to be particularly acute, though, in the professions, and I've done a little bit of work in the medico-legal context on this. I think particularly doctors and lawyers feel an expectation from the world around them that they need to be infallible. If you think about the workday of a doctor, if a doctor makes a mistake, there are huge consequences involved. So most people don't want to contemplate the idea that doctors aren't infallible. We put them onto that pedestal, and to a lesser extent, lawyers. And so that is a responsibility or a mantle that they then carry. When they do make a mistake, it's certainly not encouraged that they put it in the paper or talk about it, which puts them in a very difficult place in terms of their own mental health and how they exist as human beings. Things with unrealistic expectations, because everybody makes mistakes. That's how we learn.
Now, I know your professional life has taken you into the Kingdom of Bhutan, also referred to by some as the Land of Happiness. Tell us a little bit about your time there and how that plays into the story of Virginia.
I was really fortunate when I was teaching my Masters of Law unit in mediation to teach some judges from Bhutan who had come to Australia to do their postgraduate work. As a result of that, I was invited to Bhutan to work with their lawyers and some of the judges in their legal system to help them to understand the process of mediation as it works in our court process. Bhutan has enjoyed collaborative dispute resolution for a very long time in its tradition, but they were building Western legal systems, and I wanted to help them to retain the essence of that collaboration so that in their culture people continued to talk first and then only fight through the courts as a last resort. I ended up working as a consultant there to help create a model of mediation for their legal system that also reflected principles of Buddhism and gross national happiness. It was extraordinary to work in a country where people believe in karma, where, as a lawyer, people would do the right thing because it was the right thing, not because there were five pieces of legislation that prohibited it or provided a penalty if they did it. A place where people did the right thing even if somebody else wasn't looking. And Buddhism is such an amazing philosophy on life. For a control freak, which I must confess I was, it really helped me to understand the value of observing myself, observing the world around me as more of a detached person, which enabled me to develop a perspective that I think has made me much happier and a lot healthier as a human being.
Well, we've talked a whole lot, Melinda, about some of the problems that Virginia has in your book, but I'm going to guess, without being a spoiler, to tell people what's going to happen, that Melinda finds her way somewhere. Can you just kind of give us an idea about some of Virginia's journey as she comes maybe towards the end of the book?
Virginia turns a circle, but the circle isn't dramatic. There are no villains. There's no real crises. There are no disasters in this storyline. The entire storyline is around Virginia learning to love herself. And once she opens up to the idea that she's the only person that's been setting these ridiculous standards for herself, it isn't really the rest of the world, she could redefine what her definition of success is. And she realizes that she can be happy and relaxed without necessarily pleasing everybody around her or ticking all of the normal status symbols for success. Then she really starts to relax and enjoy her experience. She opens herself to a whole lot of other philosophies around life. She reads some fantastic books that are recommended by a spiritual healer that she meets by chance. She reads Eckhart Tolle and she reads Deepak Chopra. She reads Sonia Choquette. She decides to suspend her disbelief and to try going with the flow for a while to see whether or not that could lead her to a place where she didn't have to take responsibility for everything being good. She could just enjoy things being pleasant and easier and more joyful. And I am very pleased to say that in my own journey and in Virginia's, that's the taste that I wanted to give readers. I wanted readers to see just one illustration of somebody doing that, because if a control freak like Virginia can do it, everybody can.
What a great story. Again, the name of the book is Saving Virginia. The author is Melinda Edwards. She's joining us today on the Indie Book Publishing line from her office in Queensland, Australia. Melinda, as we begin to wrap up this evening, what do you hope, what is your hope by putting this book together that someone who, the reader who picks this up, will take away from it?
I'm hoping that it's not seen as a dogma or a prescription of what people should do. I'm really hoping that this book helps people to have the confidence that they know what's best for themselves by intuitively being themselves and being brave enough to strive for happiness on their own terms in our world. It can take you to some unconventional places but bring you so much more joy if you let up on yourself and live from that perspective.
Now, Melinda, your book's just been out for a couple of months now. Tell us a little bit about where we might be able to find Saving Virginia.
Well, I've been very fortunate. Balboa Press has made my book available on Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble. It's available in Booktopia. It's available on the Balboa Press website. It's not necessarily available in bookshops in printed form, but it can be ordered in if you want to use the ISBN number on the website. So it's available pretty much everywhere, and for less than a cup of coffee you can download an ebook. I think it's about $3.99, and for less than a cup of coffee, I like the fact that people can have an easy read around how they might think about becoming happier.
Before we go today, Melinda, I wanted to ask you, I know you've kind of retired out of law and out of academia, and you've started your own company, MeWise. Tell me a little bit, before we go, about that and where folks, if you have a website, where folks can go to learn more about you and what you're doing besides writing books.
Thank you. MeWise Proprietary Limited the website is www.mewise.com.au, but if you Google MeWise Pty Ltd, which is how we describe our companies in Australia, you will find us. The title, Me Wise, really represents what I've learned about people in my conflict resolution work. Becoming wise about me, becoming wise about yourself, how your ego often gets in the way of achieving wise solutions, can be the aha moment that helps you to achieve better outcomes. So that's what my business is about, trying to share that message, doing commercial training work in mediation, negotiation, communication, conflict resolution skills. But the other arm of it is the pro bono arm. And what I am hoping to do, as I said before, is prove that a social enterprise model can work even for a one-person business. So for every contract that I make in the commercial world, I want to take that to the developing world and provide that education, that help for those that can't afford the formal services. At the moment, I'm working with teams of youth in what I like to call the World Peace Youth Project. So in 2012, I was working in Thailand with young people, helping them to spread the message of communication rather than conflict. Of course, that's what mediation is. Then in 2013, I did my project in Bhutan, and my pro bono arm was to introduce peer mediation into schools throughout Bhutan so that young people from the very youngest ages learned how to talk through their problems rather than take their problem to somebody else to fix for them. That's particularly important in Bhutan. The democracy is just growing. People have been used to being told what to do, and they like being told what to do by their benevolent king, but it's time for them to find their voice. In 2014, I'm working with some young lawyers from the Czech Republic who are coming to spend a month with me to learn about ADR, to try to take that back to their home. I understand that in the Czech Republic, there are some real cultural impediments to having collaborative dispute resolution. And so I'm really hoping that we can spread that message of peace by empowering young people in their own communities to take this message, adapt it, and then be able to teach it through their own schools and law schools into the future. So that's what MeWise is about. I'm passionate about it. Yeah. At the moment, I'm waiting for the universe to bring me some big clients, but I'm sure it'll work. I just can't tell you what that looks like yet.
Yeah. Oh, it sounds terrific. Again, today we've been talking with Melinda Edwards. She is the author of the book Saving Virginia, and also she does a lot of other work, as you can tell, on the side. Melinda, thanks so much for being with us, and good luck with your book.
Thank you, Clint.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.